Citigroup? More like city government.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Renita Jablonski. Citigroup announced this morning its plans to give a bigger stake to the government, up to about 40%. Uncle Sam and some private investors will convert portions of preferred stock in the bank to common shares. Those private investors include the government of Singapore Investment Group and a Saudi Arabian prince. Citi will also suspend dividends under the agreement and reshape its board of directors. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
There are lots of funny names we can use to characterize today's $25 billion deal with Citigroup. Temporary receivership, pre-privatization,
conservatorship or government stewardship, but it's nationalization in reality.
Peter Hahn is a finance professor at the Cass Business School in London. He says today the debate over nationalization ended.
The government is not just taking an equity stake at 40%. Citi's deposits are guaranteed. The hand of the government really is all over the institution. The real risk is being borne by the taxpayer.
Hahn says these days it's hard to know what to teach his finance students.
Speaking at a business school, I think it's a very sad day. It's a disappointment that our capitalist system had such a large failure.
He says we need to overhaul the governance and regulation of banks to prevent this from ever happening again. For the time being, Citi has $45 billion in cash and guarantees from the government to keep afloat. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
We learned this morning the economy just had its worst showing in a quarter century. The Commerce Department says gross domestic product fell at a staggering rate of 6.2% at the end of 2008. That is well above what had been first predicted. GDP measures the total output of goods and services. And so the Dow is down 122 points, or 1.7% to 7,059. The NASDAQ is down 0.6% to 1383. The S&P 500 has hit 12-year lows, down more than 2% to 736. Shares in Europe have fallen even further this morning, and it was a mixed day for Asia. He's considered one of the most astute investors in the world, but stock in Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, is down 20% for the year. The company releases earnings today. Tomorrow, Buffett releases his annual letter to shareholders. Rico Galliano reports.
Some call him the Wizard of Omaha, but Berkshire Hathaway's earnings announcement could be a peek behind the curtain at the mere mortal named Warren Buffett.
I expect it's going to be a pretty dismal report.
That's Michael Yoshikami, president of YCM Net Advisors. Like most analysts, he predicts big losses, the result of the bad economy, and what some say were Buffett's bad investments.
There's two issues that he's being criticized. One is the capital value of assets he invests in, such as Bank of America stock. And then the second criticism is the derivative bets.
Buffett's derivative bets are that the S&P 500 will rise. He lost at least $2 billion on those bets last year. Still, Berkshire Hathaway stock has a 5-star rating from Morningstar, and Yoshikami says Buffett's no-holds-barred shareholder letters still command respect.
They are really an admission of really what worked and what didn't work. And I think that candor is something that's so much lacking that we're actually sitting here waiting for the one corporate news release that we maybe actually can trust.
In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
This is the Morning Report for Friday, February 27th at Marketplace.org. Vice President Joe Biden is in Philadelphia for the first meeting of his so-called middle-class task force. Today's focus will be raising standards of living by promoting jobs that help the environment. Ashley Milne-Tite explains.
How do green jobs and the middle class go together? Mark Allen Hughes is Philadelphia's sustainability director. He says traditionally a middle-class job was a stable job.
And a key element of stability is to be part of a growing sector. That's the attraction of this so-called green job sector, that when we're talking about renewable energy and energy efficiency in buildings, that you're making a commitment to the jobs for which you train people.
He says the sector will grow fast in coming years, fueled initially by government funding. Sushada Poynter is a newly trained energy auditor in Philly. She earns $11 an hour.
I start from the bottom and work my way up. But so far it has been a big opening door for me.
A door she expects many others to step through as people and businesses try to save money through energy conservation. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
A tax increase on the wealthy is really a tax hit on small business. That's the word from Republicans who don't like President Obama's plan to finance health care reform by rolling back tax cuts and deductions on people who make more than $250,000 a year. So is that true? From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman gives us the answer.
Most of us know a lot of small business owners who don't make anything like $250,000. But that's beside the point, says Martin Regalia. He's chief economist for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Many of the most successful small businesses, the ones that are making money, growing, and are therefore able to create jobs, will come under this new tax.
But Roseanne Altshuler of the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center insists most small business owners will dodge this bullet completely. Among taxpayers who get most of their income from their own businesses, she says,
more than half have income below $30,000, and 80% make less than $100,000. So most business owners are safe from Obama's individual income tax increases.
In the end, it's the biggest small businesses that have the most to lose. A recent survey by the National Federation of Independent Business found that nearly half of business owners with 20 to 250 employees earn over $250,000. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The government's bailout of AIG, not going so well. The company reports fourth quarter earnings Monday, and the only question is how many tens of billions of dollars it lost. Meanwhile, AIG is struggling to pay back some of the billions that U.S. taxpayers have loaned it. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Shanghai that AIG is a global machine trying to sell off its parts.
AIG is trying to sell its Asian life insurance division. It's asking $20 billion. The company China Life is interested, as is Temasek, the sovereign wealth fund of Singapore. AIG has a big footprint in Asia, in part because the company was born in Shanghai, circa 1919. Tony Tong of China Everbright Research says AIG's Asia slice is the crown jewel, especially the China part. It grows by 20% every year. So why would a firm unload its best cut of meat?
They need money to pay the loans for the debts. They have to sell something that is available.
AIG owes Uncle Sam $60 billion. In the last couple days, several potential bidders in Asia have bowed out. And if things get worse, there's talk the U.S. government will split up the parent company. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you've done some traveling abroad, you may have bought some ethnic arts and crafts for your home. Maybe a mask from Mexico, a wood carving from Kenya. But are you sure they're authentic? Globalization means more and more African arts and crafts are being made in factories that aren't even in the countries they claim to be from. Gretchen Wilson has this story from Johannesburg about real crafters struggling to compete.
This sidewalk serves as a studio for African artist Boaz Majenga. He strings wires with tiny beads to make the distinctive animal sculptures this region's known for.
This one, it's a small leopard. And this is a lion.
He's asking $35 for this lion, about the size of a house cat. It's these skills that put bread on the table for his wife and sons, and his extended family.
I think it's nearly 20 people. They depend on me, so I need to support them.
Many of the 1 million traditional craft artists in South Africa might otherwise be unemployed, but they pump more than $300 million a year into the economy. It's tough for them to compete with Chinese manufacturers who flood the market with cheaper replicas.
They can buy things at a cheaper price, then they can go there and remake it, and they make profit out of us.
And they do, at shopping malls like this one in Johannesburg, where shelves are loaded with foreign-made baskets, beaded jewelry, and wooden giraffes, all mass-produced. Priscilla Nioni is with Craft Yorona, a company that promotes local artists.
It's something that has been happening for years now, and our government hasn't been intervening.
She says there's more at stake than just employment.
That's African identity, and they're actually stealing it.
Artists sometimes turn to copyrights and intellectual property laws to protect their work, but that's expensive, so African artists are easily exploited, especially the rural poor. Anitra Nettleton is an art historian at Wits University.
They don't have access to the kinds of legal ways of protecting their designs, and so anyone can use them because there's nothing to stop. And that's immoral.
South Africa's artists are trying to innovate to keep one step ahead of look-alike imports. They say it's now up to consumers to make sure they're buying the real thing. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
We've been mentioning the Marketplace whiteboard all week. This is our series of online videos that breaks down the terms behind the fallout of the economic crisis. Our man at the whiteboard, senior editor Patty Hirsch, is with us now to answer some of the questions that have come in from listeners this week. Patty, I'm so used to seeing you at the whiteboard. Nice to have you in the studio for a change.
Well, it's very nice to be here. Thank you.
One of the most popular videos is the one about credit default swaps, and we happen to get a couple questions about this. The first one comes from Minneapolis, and this person asks, why offer collateral to get someone to buy insurance on investments? That doesn't happen anywhere else.
It's absolutely right. It doesn't happen anywhere else. Well, certainly not in our world. You know, if we're insuring a car or a house, you don't ask the insurance company to put up collateral. We just expect it to survive, right? In the credit default swap world, these guys that are buying insurance, they are essentially hedging. You know, if there is any problems in their portfolio, they want to hedge against it. And whenever they buy anything, they want to be hedged. And they might look at this person who's selling them insurance and say, I want to make sure that if there's any problems with you, I'm hedged against that, and therefore I want some collateral. And the guy who's selling him insurance is happy about that because he's also buying and selling insurance himself. He's hedging everything. So he understands that this person who he's selling insurance to wants to be hedged. He also wants to be hedged, so he says, okay, I'll put up a little collateral for you. That'll make you feel good, and you know, it's a little bit of a sweetener to get you into my deal.
And then comes a company like AIG, which lost a lot of money because it couldn't live up to those commitments for credit default swaps. That brings us to this question from a listener in Florida that says, you know, with that and the fact that AIG had backed up a lot of banks with credit default swaps, aren't we paying twice for the same loss?
Well, we should probably go back and talk about what it was that initially got AIG into trouble. And that, again, is this collateral issue. You know, AIG had this collateral that it had put up, and it had an agreement that said if its credit rating fell, then it would have to put up more collateral, that is to say, more cash. And that's exactly what happened. Whenever Lehman Brothers went into bankruptcy, there was a systemic failure or potential systemic failure. The rating agencies dropped the ratings on a number of financial services companies, including AIG. AIG then had to put up more money. And that was money that it didn't have.
So what you're saying is we may very well be paying more than twice.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Lots of questions we weren't able to get to, Patty, and we hope to have you back to do that. Senior editor Patty Hirsch, also known as our whiteboard guru. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Check out the whiteboard series at marketplace.org. And another reminder, your cure for Scott Jagow withdrawal is also at marketplace.org. If you haven't looked at his Scratchpad blog, please do. Very interesting reading. In Los Angeles, I'm Renita Jablonski. Have a nice weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.